It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The Associated Press now reporting that Stephen Paddock actually requested the room in the Mandalay Bay so that he could fire down on that concert crowd from two separate windows. All the while, he also had three separate cameras aiming at the hallway of the hotel so that he could see when police were closing in. And we are now learning a great deal more about those deadly first 10 minutes. Newly released police body cam video shows what responders saw on the ground as the attack in Las Vegas unfolded.
Hey, they're shooting right at us, guys. Everybody stay down. Stay down.
Where's it at?
North of the Mandalay Bay. It's coming out of a window.
And scanner audio reveals the moment police entered the room, Paddock turned into a sniper's nest.
Breach, breach, breach. We are clearing this room. We have one suspect down.
Deeper 20 has one suspect down inside the room.
Finding Paddock on the floor, dead from an apparent suicide. FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe said investigators are reconstructing the shooter's life, behavior, and pattern, all in an effort to figure out exactly what motivated Paddock.
All right, so that's the first part of Trace Gallagher's report on Fox, a special report last night on Fox. Sandy Rios with you. Yeah, we're learning more things. The Las Vegas sheriff gave his daily briefing, and a couple of interesting points, three actually, that I want to make. Stephen Paddock, the shooter, they say they have evidence now that he planned to survive. He did not plan to kill himself. And that was not a suicide note, according to the sheriff, that was lying on the table that some of you may have seen in that photograph where you see the Stephen Paddock's feet and you see one of the guns because he's dead, he's killed himself. And there's a note. Many people speculated it might have been a suicide note. The sheriff said, no, it was not. They also said that the sheriff speculated he might have likely had some help at some point. I have to say that I heard Andrew McCabe, the deputy FBI director, who is completely disgraced and still in place. He's the one who... His wife got $700,000 from Terry McAuliffe to run for Senate. He worked on her campaign, which is a breach of FBI rules. He lied on his forms about her income, and he's still in place. So when I hear him say that he's the one heading up this investigation, I don't have confidence. I have no confidence. So anyway, there was another thing that came up that I think this is really interesting. Trace now brings us up to date a little bit with the girlfriend, Marilou Danley. Let's listen to what Trace has to say.
Much of the focus now shifts to Marilou Danley, Paddock's girlfriend, who returned from the Philippines into Los Angeles last night. She was questioned today after being labeled a person of interest. Danley's sisters insist she knew nothing about Paddock's plans.
And I know that she don't know anything as well. Like, she was sent away. She was sent away so that she will be not there to interfere or put his planning. In that sense, I thank him for sparing my sister's life. But that won't be to compensate 59 people's life.
And we have just learned, Brett, that the FBI questioning of Marilou Danley may be finished for the day because her lawyer just came out and addressed the media saying that she is cooperating, that she does not know anything about the shooting, and that she did confirm that he wired $100,000 to the Philippines. And she ended by saying, or he ended by saying, that she would do anything she could to help the pain and suffering of the victims and their families.
All right, so this is what we've learned. We learned a lot of things about Marilou Danley, but, you know, I spoke, I believe it was Monday, I said to you, they have to get her back. She will lawyer up, and then they won't get information. So it's been 3 days, So don't think that the information is not being managed by her attorney. Her sisters, I thought, were very compelling in that interview. Their faces were covered. They sort of, you know, you heard what they said. It was very compelling. But this is interesting to me. ABC actually found her brother, Ronaldo Bustos, and interviewed him. And now I'm going to let you hear the audio. And as you listen to the audio, I'm going to tell you what he says, because he's speaking in his native tongue. He immediately, as soon as he found out that her boyfriend that she's been living with for numbers of years had just killed, you know, 58 people and had injured nearly 500. So he's all upset. He calls his sister. And I'm guessing, you know, this is what I think, you know, what would you say if you were the sister and this is your brother calling you and you just heard this too? What would you say? Would you say, I don't know what he was doing. This is, I'm heartbroken. He's dead. You know, what happened? I didn't see any of this. I can't believe it. But this is really what he reports that she said. Again, he was in the Philippines, so he doesn't have the benefit of an attorney, and he doesn't have the benefit of anybody spinning what he's going to say. This was the raw footage of Ronaldo Bustos, the brother of Marilu Danley, speaking to ABC. Let's listen. When I heard the news, we called her. She told us, you just relax. There's nothing for you to worry about because, she said, we'll make things right. But us, our consciences are clear, so don't panic. That's what she told us. So that's why until now I haven't called her. Because I'm putting trust in her word, she said, I'll fix this. You don't have to worry, she said. Brother, just relax. The words she was using. I didn't get the feeling that she was scared or surprised or anything like that. She was very relaxed when she said to me. All right, well, I took less time than he did. That's, we'll cut the clip off, but that's what he's saying. And I just think, listen, I'm just telling you, there's more to this story. I do not believe that she did not know anything. I don't believe that. I don't believe that's possible. And I'm a commentator again. I'm not a news person. I'm telling you my hunches, and they are not good on that issue. John Roberts yesterday reported about President Trump making his visit to Las Vegas. I understand one of the guys in the hospital who had not been able to stand up stood and said, I want to stand for my president, one of the guys that was injured. Very moving, I'm sure, for President Trump and for him. This is what John Roberts had to say about it.
For President Trump, Sunday's mass murder is personal. He has longstanding ties to Las Vegas, a big hotel here. He wanted to come here as quickly as possible to comfort the wounded and to praise acts of heroism that he says helped minimize the loss of life.
It was a presidential tribute to heroes who ran straight into danger, risking their lives to save others.
We're defined by our love, our caring, and our courage. In the darkest moments, what shines most brightly is the goodness that thrives in the hearts of our people. That goodness is our lighthouse.
President Trump gave his personal thanks to law enforcement, who braved a hail of bullets to get people out of harm's way at Sunday's concert, and within minutes were outside the shooter's door on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay.
You showed the world, and the world is watching, and you showed what professionalism is all about.
The president also honored civilians, some of whom perished, for putting aside their fears and their own safety, taking extraordinary measures to protect and help others.
Parents and spouses used their own bodies as shields to protect their loved ones. Americans dashed into a hail of bullets to rescue total strangers.
At University Medical Center, President Trump met with many victims of the shooting, some suffering grievous wounds, and had high praise for surgeons, nurses, and hospital staff who saved the lives of so many.
I just want to congratulate everybody. It's incredible. Incredible what you've done. We met quite a few people, and believe me, they are very lucky to be here.
All right, so that's what the president said yesterday, at least in part, in Las Vegas. And, of course, the Democrats, I don't need to tell you, have wasted no time politicizing this on the issue of gun control. John has a great report on that, but I'm going to skip it because you know that. We played a lot of the clips yesterday when we were talking with Professor John Lott. By the way, I commend my conversation with him yesterday. If you didn't hear it, go on our Facebook page or do the podcast and listen to what he has to say. But I found it You know, one of the things that they're doing is attacking the NRA. And I want to read this. I just think this is really interesting from the Daily Caller this morning. The Federalist, Molly Hemingway, is becoming the most famous Federalist. But believe me, some of them, you've certainly, Stella Morabito, other writers, they are one of the greatest, best outlets, most reliable, on just thinking, deep thinking, not necessarily news that's breaking. And Sean Davis is the co-founder. And Washington Post read an article listing $3.6 million in NRA political donations in the past few decades. Sean Davis, though, pointed out Planned Parenthood's political donations last year alone absolutely dwarfed that number. The reporter uses basic division on above tweet, and you won't believe what happens next. Since 1998, the NRA has donated $3,555,194 to current members of Congress. Washington Post contributor Kyle Griffin tweeted with a link to the WaPo story. Find out here who has received those donations. Davis replied, a whopping $190,000 a year the NRA gave spread out across 400 races. Huh? Planned Parenthood spent $38 million just last year. It takes a special brand of D.C. stupid to insinuate $3.5 million over 20 years is game-changing when last year's candidates spent $6.8 billion. All right, so just to be really clear, the NRA spent $3,555,194 since 1998. That's $190,000 a year spread out over 400 races. And they're supposed to be, the wicked player in this whole shooting in Las Vegas. Planned Parenthood spent $38 million just last year. We'll put that on our Facebook page. You can share it. It's Daily Caller about Federalist co-founder uses basic math to put Planned Parenthood in its place. I told you yesterday we had John Lott, who's a professor of economics, who deals with the numbers on gun control, and you can listen to that. But I want to also point out, interestingly enough, the Washington Post printed an article by Leah Libresco yesterday. She's a statistician and a former news writer at 538. She says, before I start researching gun deaths, gun control policy used to frustrate me. I wish the National Rifle Association would stop blocking common sense gun control reforms, such as banning assault weapons, restricting silencers, shrinking magazine size, blah, 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 blah. Then my colleagues and I at 538 spent 3 months analyzing all 33,000 lives ended by guns each year in the U.S., and I wound up frustrated in a whole new way. She breaks it down. I don't have time to read all that, but she says, as my coworkers and I kept looking at the data, it seemed less and less clear that one broad gun control restriction could make a big difference. By the time we published our project, I didn't believe many of the interventions I'd heard politicians tout. I was still anti-gun, but I can't endorse policies whose only selling point is that gun owners hate them. It's a much longer article than that. We'll put that on our Facebook page as well. Just really interesting. And as a counter to that, Breitbart is reporting, as of yesterday, the Democrats are scared to death, really, in spite of what they're boasting and saying, about using gun control because of the 2018 election coming up. And lots of them are running in red states. So they're backing off. They're pretty much dropping their demands to deregulating suppressors. And meanwhile, Paul Ryan jumps to the fore and says that the NRA-backed bill to ease regulations on gun silencers, and that isn't about crimes. That's about gunmen who are going deaf because of the sounds of guns. In fact, even this girl that I just read to you in Washington Post says that they really have not. The notion people get about silencers comes from movies. This is something that will help gun owners not to have hearing loss. But Ryan remains mum on national reciprocity for concealed carry, and he's pulled any consideration of stopping this the quieting, really, of guns for gun owners so that they don't go deaf. He's not even going to vote on that. He says it's dead for now. He tweeted that. He says it's shelved indefinitely. So he's rushing to moderate while the Democrats are running away from it because of the 2018 election. And that's how it goes, ladies and gentlemen. That's how it goes. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
So What would you do with an extra $500 a month in your budget? $500. This isn't hypothetical, by the way. This is something you may need to think about very soon if you decide to become a member of MediShare. MediShare is a way to pay for your health care, and typically it costs $500 less per month for a family versus other health care plans. So seriously, think about this. You could pay off loans, pay down a mortgage, save the money for retirement, donate to charity. That would be a big deal. But you know what? Here's the best thing. MediShare works. It has 250,000 members, and it's growing fast. With MediShare, not only do you save, you don't have to pay for things you don't believe in either. And that is a beautiful thing, too. So here's how you can find out more, and you might actually wind up saving even more than $500 a month. So check into it. Here's the number. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23, now available in Montana. 855-PSALM-23.
Hi, I'm Dina from Virginia. I've been listening to AFR almost daily for about 3 years now. My husband was the one who found the AFR station in our area. And prior to discovering AFR, I had a heartbreaking experience of having to leave my beloved church because of the lack of true leadership and the lack of true meat and potatoes biblical teaching. I feel like AFR has personally taken me under their wings and have been educating me to be a stronger, more compassionate soldier in this good fight. Thank you, AFR, for all you do for the body of Christ. We will continue to support you and pray the Lord will continue to bless your ministry and keep it strong until He returns. God bless you.
Ensure that we impact even more lives by partnering with us during our 3-day Share-a-thon starting October 17th. Listener-supported American Family Radio. For your family.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Dr. Robert Bowen. I am the Dean of Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics, and I'm an Associate Professor of Physiology. So one of the benefits of being a faculty member at TMU is not only are we allowed to speak the gospel in the classroom and within our areas of discipline, we're encouraged to do so. Everybody needs to know the love of Christ. And so I try to incorporate in my classes, and one of the places that I incorporate in the most is in my office when I have students come in.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
Matthew Vitale is a conservative student at the University of California in Riverside. He showed up to a seminar the other day wearing a Make America Great Again ball cap. After the seminar, a fellow student raced up to Matthew and swiped the hat right off his head. The student began cursing and demanding Matthew be punished for promoting hate speech. She called the hat a symbol of violent anti-immigrant white supremacy. University administrators stood by and did nothing. But Matthew stood his ground. He initially declined to press charges, but it turns out snatching something from another person's body is a felony in California. So Matthew filed a police report, and once that happened, the university released a statement calling the attack an unfortunate incident. An unfortunate incident that also happens to be a crime. By the way, Matthew? Yeah, he got his hat back. I'm Todd Starnes.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
One lawmaker I talked to today said for this to go anywhere in the Senate, it literally would take a miracle or divine intervention. It's been there before back in 2015 when Democrats controlled the Senate. They easily blocked it. But you know, as a minority party, they can do that as well this time around because you got to get those 60 votes just to get it procedurally moving to any debate. That is a tough hill for this bill from the House. I talked to Congressman Trent Franks, GOP member who sponsored this bill. He says that 60-vote threshold in the Senate, he's calling it a huge problem. Here's what he said.
That's the only rule like it in any parliamentary body in the world that I know of where the majority of the body cannot bring a bill to the floor for debate and amendment. But that is the case right now.
I think we should bring it to the floor, and I think they will bring it to the floor. And in the coming new year, we're going to have this on the floor, and we should actually have this debate.
Of course, the president has said he will sign this bill, but there are plenty of Democrats and lawmakers out there in the Senate saying that's not going to be necessary. It won't get past them. And they say even if it did, they view this as completely unconstitutional. There have been states that have passed 20-week bans, and they've had varying success. The Ninth Circuit, which we know leans to the left, has struck down these bans out of Arizona and Idaho. North Carolina's got one at 18 weeks. That's tied up in litigation. In Georgia, the state Supreme Court there said it wouldn't hear a ban, a case about the ban on the 20 weeks there. So the Supreme Court has not heard this kind of case. Now, in Arizona law, lost at the Ninth Circuit. They tried to appeal this to the Supreme Court. They didn't take the case. Right now, there's another issue playing out at the Supreme Court we've been watching with Missouri. They've been fighting. Planned Parenthood has a couple of restrictive abortion bills there. They put an emergency request with the Supreme Court because they wanted those bills tossed. They've now withdrawn that request from the Supreme Court because they got a favorable lower court ruling, but that's one of those cases that could end up there.
All right, that was Shannon Bream on Fox last night. And you probably know that the House did vote on that 20-week abortion ban. That's the time at which they tell us that little unborn babies can start to feel pain. Surgeons won't do surgery on babies at 20 weeks because they feel pain. So it's a logical statement to make that there should not be abortions. Most of us believe there shouldn't be abortions before 20 weeks, but this is a scientific argument that should not be able to be ignored. However, I guarantee you, based on what Shannon just said, what Trent Franks, who sponsored the bill in the House, just said, it will be stopped in the Senate. I don't know what the senator from Oklahoma, whose name escapes me in the moment, was talking about when he said, we'll bring it to the floor. They can't bring it to the floor without 60 votes, and they're not going to have 60 votes in the Senate. And I have to say to you that AFA has been on a lone man campaign to get Senator McConnell to drop this 60-vote filibuster rule on legislation, and he just won't. He just hasn't, because it is stopping fine legislation from going through. And I have to say, I've heard the arguments from the other side that, but when the Republicans are in control again, or in the minority again, they'll need that ruling in order to stop the bad stuff the Democrats are going to do. But I have to tell you, the Democrats are going to do that bad stuff anyway, and they will not hesitate stopping that 60-vote rule when they're in charge. So this is not business as usual. These are dangerous times. And AFA Action and AFA are asking you to call your senator and ask them to demand that Senator McConnell drop this 60-vote threshold. This legislation is not going anywhere. And I might say, too, this is the dark side. I just have to tell you, because I do always tell you the truth, don't I? Yesterday I heard that there were some nine Republican members begging leadership not to bring this bill up. And some of them are closely connected with leadership. They didn't want to vote on the bill, but they knew they had to vote as though they were pro-life, but they didn't want to go on record with it. But to his credit, Paul Ryan brought it up anyway. But of course, Paul Ryan and all of those that voted for this know, as Trent Frank just told you, it's going nowhere in the Senate. And it was based on this, what they call the long game, which has been pushed by some pro-life leaders who I totally disagree with. They did not push the defunding of Planned Parenthood when those David Dalyden videos came out showing the exchange of money for baby body parts. They were unwilling because, that would, we might just shut down the government now, and that would, and saving babies and the horror of their body parts being harvested, even unbeknownst to their mothers, was not bad enough for them to take a stand. So they told us, they patted us on the head, said, hey, we're going to do we'll do the long game. We're going to educate people. So this is part of the long game, the 20-week ban, and they passed it. So now they can go back and campaign and say, yes, they heroically, they're pro-life, they passed this, but they know full well it won't pass in the Senate. So I'm jaded. Yes, I am. By the way, interesting news, Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania has resigned. He's a Republican congressman. He is, I guess, what you'd call a rhino, but he has, I guess I would say that. He has claimed that he's pro-life. He's a strong and frequent critic of abortion, but the bad news is he had an affair with a woman named Shannon Edwards and tried to talk her into having an abortion. He's married with a grown daughter. So Shannon Edwards actually went public assailing him for his hypocrisy. Now he's been forced to resign. But I have to say the good news on that, if there is good news, I'm not happy about that. What's going on with these guys? Do you see that for all of us? When we do not keep God's boundaries, and I don't know where Tim is spiritually, but he surely knows that he shouldn't be having an affair and getting a woman pregnant and encouraging her to have an abortion. When we cross God's boundaries, there are such serious consequences, not only for us, but also for the people involved, for our families. And in the moment, it may not seem like, it seems like everyone's doing it. I'm sure on Capitol Hill, it certainly does seem that way. But there are real consequences Even for those who don't embrace God, there are consequences for breaking his laws. And so that brings me to a couple of other stories. I have so much to tell you. I'm going to jump into this. Catherine Herridge last night had a really interesting report because, you see, I found out yesterday there are three committees in Congress going after Donald Trump and his connection to the Russians. Still, there are zero committees going after Hillary Clinton and her email, or all the revelations that came out from the John Podesta email. No investigations at all on anything on the other side. No investigations, as far as I know, not to mention. But they are really going after Donald Trump and the Russian. Three committees, and they are Republican-led, might I add. So Catherine Herridge did this report last night, which makes it even more stunning. Let's listen.
After 9 months of investigation and more than 100 witness interviews, the Senate Intelligence Committee leadership offered no concrete evidence of coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia, telling reporters today there's more work ahead.
The issue of collusion is still open, that we continue to investigate both intelligence and witnesses, and that we're not in a position where we will come to any type of temporary finding on that until we've completed the process.
The senator said the next phase will include public hearings, inviting the president's longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen, to testify October 25th, though a source close to Cohen said his appearance is not firm. And the committee has an invitation out to Facebook, Google, and Twitter to publicly testify November 1st. Asked about Russian-backed ads during the campaign, the senator said the goal was division, not helping a particular candidate or party.
They used the social media firms both in terms of paid advertising and what I believe is more problematic, but created false accounts and others that would drive interest towards stories or groups. And generally, those stories or groups were to sow chaos and drive division in our country.
The senators could not determine the credibility of the unverified salacious Trump dossier compiled by former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele. The dossier helped kickstart the FBI's counterintelligence investigation last year into alleged Russian collusion. Senators said Steele refused to identify his sources and who paid him.
Unfortunately, the committee has hit a wall. We have on several occasions made attempts to contact Mr. Steele, to meet with Mr. Steele. Those offers have gone unaccepted.
And the senators say the Russian campaign continued after the election, and they expect a more aggressive targeted campaign during the midterm elections.
You know, I heard someone mention, I think it was a caller to Rush Limbaugh a couple of days ago, and it's so brilliant, I had to give attribution, because he pointed out that the FBI, which is in charge of the investigation of the shooter. And, of course, I told you earlier that Gary McCabe, the disgraced, from my perspective, man in charge of these things at the FBI right now, is overseeing this investigation of the shooter. And what is background? We just don't know, you see. We just can't figure out. So within less than 24 hours, as I told you earlier, the FBI declared that there was no international terrorism connection with the shooter. Oh, they're sure. They're adamant. Absolutely no connection. They were able to, you know, miraculously, I guess, review everything he had in every house. He had three houses, and everything in his computer. They were able to trace all that down and say without equivocation. But it's taken 9 months, and they still can't find a link between Donald Trump's campaign and the Russians. Still not sure. And I need to point out that was Richard Burris, who's heading this committee, one of these committees that are looking into this, primarily Trump's connection with the Russians. Richard Burr, you know, is Burr. What did I say? That's his name, Senator Richard Burr from North Carolina, who is just a rhino all the way and a never Trumper. So here we go, and I've got some more to say about that. But I want to get before I get off of what Catherine said in the exact scandal with the Russians. The Department of Justice, according to WND, is demanding the U.S. Attorney's Office for Washington, D.C. release records relating to the murder of Democratic National Committee employee Seth Rich. You will recall we spent a long time talking about this. Seth Rich on the streets of Washington, D.C., murdered by, I believe it was two gunmen, just shot, killed. And the official word by the Metropolitan Police and Washington Mayor Muriel Bowers, who absolutely hates the president, is a radical. But they've decided that Rich was only randomly killed during a botched robbery. That's the official report. Problem is, he was found with his wallet, credit cards, and other valuables. If you haven't been tracking this, Rich was working for the DNC. He had access to all of their email and WikiLeaks. Julian Assange right away offered $20,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of Rich's killer, because he was hinting that Rich was their source. It wasn't the Russians. That's what Assange has insisted repeatedly. It was not the Russians who gave us those email. It was a lot of email. John Podesta's, I think, was some of the most damning. But now there are a ton of rewards to any information on people that would know about Seth Rich's murder. The America News Network is offering $100,000, Metropolitan Police Department $25,000, and another businessman and investor is offering $100,000. So the DNC didn't offer any reward for the finding of anybody that knows who shot or how the crime was perpetrated. Instead, they honored Seth Rich by dedicating a bike rack outside of its headquarters in Rich's memory. And the issue is, how can they possibly say it was a random shooting and of a robbery when he was found with all of his valuables on him? How can they say that? That in itself should be a red flag. And so hopefully the DOJ will look into that. I mentioned briefly, but I need to go back to it, that Richard Burr from North Carolina is one of the Republicans leading this attempt to link Donald Trump with the Russians, and reminds me of an article I read this morning from Politico, and this is the title, More GOP Senators Willing to Tell Trump to Take a Hike, and it traces the obstruction. I heard this week that Republicans, whoever, you fill in the blanks, Republicans of various stripes are intent upon impeaching President Trump. They're working behind the scenes. They're dragging their feet. They're doing everything they can to stop his agenda. As a matter of fact, that brings me to one particular person I will mention. That's Senator John McCain. The Pentagon only has 30% of its positions filled. They've been nominated, but they need Senate confirmation in order to fill the other 70%. But guess who's stopping this? Senator John McCain is refusing to advance U.S. President Donald Trump's nominees to the Pentagon until he is satisfied the administration is communicating its plans for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it talks about a tense committee hearing between Jim Mattis, Joseph Dunford, McCain. And McCain is just saying, when I got reelected, I said I would support and defend the Constitution. I didn't say I would support and defend the President of the United States. So there you go, Mr. McCain obstructing those nominees, really crucial to our national security, and he's not doing anything. And I would also say on the judicial front, this is appalling, appalling. Only 7 Trump judges have been confirmed by the Senate. He has a list of fabulous judges, but 148 federal court vacancies, 47 nominated judges, and the Senate has confirmed 7 in the last month. And that is because Mitch McConnell is allowing that rule to stay in place, about a 30-hour debate for each nominee. He's allowing Senator from Iowa, Grassley, who's head of the Judiciary Committee, is continuing to allow senators to file a blue slip to stop any vote on any judicial nominee that they don't particularly like. So in the blue states, for instance, California, New York, nothing is moving ahead. President Trump's nominees haven't got a chance because these old dogs of the Senate, I will say that, will not do anything about their precious, sacred rules. And McConnell has been blaming the Democrats. Trust me, they're doing their part too. But I will read to you what this writer, Natalia Castro, says. The inaction is stunning. So there's the reality of what's happening, and we just need to continue to pray. Coming up next, something that will encourage you. A new biography is out. It's the 500th year anniversary of the Reformation. Eric Metaxas, one of my favorite biographers, it has just written, it's just out this week, a new biography on Martin Luther. And so Eric will join us next, so you'll want to stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
For the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Corner. During his final year in office, the Obama administration spent a record $36.2 million on legal costs to defend its refusal to turn over federal records under the Freedom of Information Act. Millions of dollars were spent to keep the American public from receiving pertinent information about our government from the most transparent administration in history. $36.2 million to go to court to protect its refusal to release information to the American public is a lot of money to spend to keep secrets. It leaves me wondering, what are they hiding?
Visit the Hamilton Corner on the podcast page at AFR.net for more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
If you're not already listening to AFR Talk Saturday nights at 10 Central, just listen to what you're missing.
At the bottom of all of this, a child is afraid. I'm saying this not so that we can, in a Freudian kind of way, diagnose people, but we can explain and say, well, that's because it wasn't done biblically. Some people would just say, you know, love is enough. It needs more than that. It needs good theology.
Don't miss Wretched Radio with Todd Freedom every Saturday night at 10 Central on AFR Talk.
Many in America seem to have forgotten that its foundation was built on God. In this 40th year celebration of the American Family Association, we invite you to help us remind America once again of the truth behind our national motto, In God We Trust. You can do your part and display your faith with an In God We Trust car decal from the AFA store. Order yours today with free shipping at afastore.net. That's afastore.net.
I feel so hopeless.
Is there any hope? I just feel like there's no hope at all.
Is there any hope?
Get hope. Do you feel that changes in life are hard to accept?
That's TWR President Lauren Libby.
Change is often unsettling. It can lead to a loss of hope and insecurity. A fact of life is the only thing that's certain is change. The prophet Isaiah said, "The former things I declared of old, and suddenly I did them, and they came to pass." In the margin of my Bible, I have six specific dates noted next to this verse. These were times when God was preparing me for major changes in my life. Jesus prepares us and doesn't leave us alone in the change process. Hope comes from trusting Jesus in the midst of huge change.
Need more hope? We have resources waiting for you, including a free devotional. You'll find them at gethoperadio.com. That's gethoperadio.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Iran is not complying with its obligations under the Obama bomb deal that is supposed to prevent the mullahs from getting the bomb for at least another decade. That's not exactly news. It's been true from the inception of this so-called political understanding. But the International Atomic Energy Agency recently acknowledged the Iranians aren't allowing its inspectors to visit sites believed to be covertly engaged in illegal nuclear weapons-related work. President Trump simply cannot certify that Iran is in compliance with what he knows is the worst deal ever negotiated. Mr. Trump is being urged to say so, but to stay in it. Ostensibly, we'll be able to fix it, but that ain't gonna happen. As Ambassador John Bolton has argued, it's time to end this national security fraud, not perpetuate it, and to renew sanctions before the threat metastasizes further. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The sale of indulgences in Germany infuriated Luther, and on October 31st, 1517, he nailed a document containing 95 theses against this and other practices to the church door in Wittenberg. Within 2 weeks, the 95 theses were copied and distributed all over Europe, causing a huge challenge to the church's authority. Pope Leo responded by issuing a papal bull condemning Luther and ordered him to recant under the peril of excommunication. Luther burned the papal bull publicly. And in 1521, Leo issued the formal bill of excommunication, calling Luther a wild boar in the forest whose tongue was a fire seeking to destroy the church. The Pope then urged Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, and highest civil magistrate to execute the excommunication order and to eradicate this heresy. Charles commanded Luther to appear before the Imperial Diet of Worms to recant. On April 17, 1521, Luther appeared before the august assembly of the emperor, his princes, dukes, courtiers, and the papal delegation from Rome. Displayed on a great table were Luther's writings. The great number of books made Charles marvel that such a young man could have written so much. Johann Eck, acting as spokesman and Luther's principal adversary, gave a stinging indictment of Luther and his writings. He then asked Luther whether he acknowledged the authorship of these books. Luther did. Eck then asked Luther if he was prepared to recant the errors contained therein. At this, Luther hesitated. His confidence failed him. He could offer only a timid reply, in tones so subdued that they could hardly be heard. He asked for one more day to consider the matter. The assembly reluctantly granted his request.
That was Max MacLean, of course, famous Max MacLean, reading an excerpt of his own writings about Martin Luther. It is the 500th anniversary. We are approaching the exact day of it, actually, of the Reformation. And Eric Metaxas has written a brand new book. It's out just this week, called Martin Luther, The Man Who Rediscovered God and Changed the World. Eric is really came to my attention and became one of my favorite authors when he wrote his book on Bonhoeffer. I loved that book. I spent probably a year just meditating, and the Eric's insights on Bonhoeffer were just incredible. And I'm so looking forward to reading this book, because it is on another person who really changed the world, and that's Martin Luther. Eric, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, Sandy, thanks for having me. Wonderful.
You know, in a nutshell, I'm glad Max kind of summarized a little bit, gave people a flavor of who he is, because we don't have time to talk about all the things that he is. But in a nutshell,
question. If I can't give it in a nutshell, we're in trouble. I feel like that's my job. When you write a book, you know, about a man who did so much, you do have to kind of figure out, why should people read this book? Who is this guy? And I have to tell you, this is always the case with me when I write books. I don't know that much going into it. I just know enough that I should do this. God wants me to tell the story. And as I get into it, I'm kind of knocked on my rear end with my own ignorance. I can't even believe that I didn't know what I discover. I mean, Luther's story, first of all, I say this, you know, for people who are thinking of reading the book, it is a wildly entertaining story. I mean, this is not a sad story. You know, of course, the Bonhoeffer book is kind of hard to read. You're talking about the Holocaust and the Nazis. I mean, this is a wild romp, in a way, through history. You can't even believe what went on at the time. But the nutshell version is that I say Luther's story is our story, because he was obsessed with figuring out the answers to the big questions. Is there a God? And if this God exists, which Luther believed he did, what is he like? Is he a glowering judge who almost hates us, and we fear him, and we almost hate him? We just want to do what he wants us to do to get him off our back so we can go to heaven, so we don't go to hell. You know, the first part of his life, when he was a monk, he was kind of obsessed, not kind of obsessed. He was totally obsessed with doing everything right and confessing every sin and praying harder and fasting more and doing all that. And he found that he could not find peace. He said, what am I doing wrong? This doesn't make any sense. I'm doing this harder than anybody else. I'm working it harder, and nothing is happening. And, of course, this leads him to depression, to craziness. I mean, he can't figure it out. And finally, he was doing something that nobody else was doing at the time, and this is a fact. He was studying the Bible. That was just not the thing to do in late medieval Christendom. And so he figures, maybe in here someplace I can find a golden key, something. And around 1517, about the same time that he nails the 95 Theses on Indulgences, the same year, he discovers this thing that's been hiding in plain sight for centuries, or I should say maybe not hiding, maybe it's been buried under tradition and so on and so forth, the concept of grace, the concept that God has already done everything that needs to be done. All we could do is accept that by faith and respond with gratitude, so that our good works are not done out of fear, but out of joy and gratitude. This is called the good news. And I think when he discovered this, he just thought, this is, how is it possible we've missed this? And so he spent the rest of his life really trying to get that message across. And at first he did it very timidly. It's kind of funny. We think of him as this big rebel and this boar in the Lord's vineyard, the way that Pope Leo puts it in this bull excommunicating him. But he was very timid, very humble. He loved the church. And so, by the way, this is, to my mind, not an anti-Catholic story, and I'm certainly not writing from that point of view. This is a man who loved God and loved the church and figured, I want to do everything I can to help them see the error of their ways. And he wasn't sort of, you know, beating his chest. He was very humble about it. But what happened, unfortunately, in history, sometimes everything goes wrong. And the response to him was terrible. It was kind of like the response of a giant corporation to a whistleblower. First thing they do, they just want to crush him. And in the past, the church was so powerful, they've been able to crush dissent. I mean, when you have Wycliffe or Tyndale, those guys didn't have the printing press on their side. But Luther, even before he used it as a weapon, he would write things, and the printing press, people would just print what he wrote and sell it without giving him any royalties. So his ideas got out way beyond him. So even if they had crushed him or they had burned him at the stake, which they wanted to do, the Reformation ideas had gotten out beyond Luther, and that's really why it caught on and spread and became a movement. And then later in his life, he did become much more of a wild man, and that's one of the reasons he's so entertaining. I mean, I actually said the other day that he's so outspoken and rude at times, he makes Donald Trump look like Mike Pence. That is saying a lot. You know, but I tell you, he's certainly entertaining. I'll give him that.
Eric, actually, you answered one of my questions, because it does seem in the early years when he was struggling in Scripture, and his supervisor in the monastery was, you know, telling him not to fret so much, not to stress so much.
Stop confessing every stray thought of pride or whatever. He was driving his supervisor crazy, his von Staupitz. And so it becomes comical that he's confessing at one point for 6 hours straight. I mean, it became crazy.
And then to see him morph into something so larger than life and hilarious, you know, his wife, Katie, and the nuns coming in a beer barrel. It is an incredible story. But I want to ask him, This really bothers me. I was on a Reformation tour with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, who I know you know well. He's a dear friend of mine. And we visited a lot of the Reformation sites, including Geneva and, of course, Wittenberg and all of that. And I was just in Scotland and saw the plaques of the martyrs there from the Scottish Reformation in St. Andrews. But the thing that struck me, Eric, was that Christians then were willing to die for points of theology. I mean,
well,
I don't want to reduce it.
That's part of why I'm excited to tell the story, because it makes us think about that. What are we willing to die for? Anything? Do we take it that seriously? I mean, these were people who understood. I mean, the reason Luther is in many ways such a hero, he was not perfect, by the way, in case anybody thinks I'm turning him out to be a perfect saint, but the reason he's heroic is that when he understood what the Bible said and what God was saying, there was no way he was going to fear what man could do to him more than he feared God. He said, I've got to speak the truth. God forbid that I would shrink from speaking the truth because I'm trying to save my own skin. That would be the worst thing I could do. So he really paints a picture of what faith is supposed to look like. You're supposed to know what you believe and then be willing to die for it, as people have through the centuries. And, of course, he didn't die for it. God kept him alive for many decades. But it's kind of a funny thing that, you know, this is the 500th anniversary. Hard to believe. At the end of this month, we celebrate 500 years exactly at the end of the month. And that's the only reason, really, Sandy, that I was persuaded to write the book, because at first I thought, do I want to write another biography? People are going to compare it to Bonhoeffer, and it's going to be this. And I don't know that I want to get involved in a whole. But I became convinced that this man's story, and this is no hyperbole, that he is the most influential person to live in the last 2,000 years, apart from Jesus. And that sounds like hyperbole, but I'm sure I back it up in my book, that what he did by taking the stand opened the door to the future. Everything we take for granted, freedom, the kind of freedom we have in America, all of that, religious freedom, none of it was possible until Luther did what he did. And he didn't do it single-handedly. He didn't even do it intentionally. But God used him to open the door to what we call freedom. That is gigantic, and the story needs telling.
Let me interject that Eric is going to be speaking. For those of you in Virginia, he'll be at the Family Foundation Saturday night at Richmond, Virginia, on October the 7th. And if you'd like to go and hear him, because he's going to be talking about this brand new book, and of course he'll have more time than we have this morning.
And I'll be signing books.
And signing books, familyfoundation.org, familyfoundation.org, for those of you in the Virginia area. It's this Saturday night. You know, when you talk about his influence, one thing, Eric, that you didn't have a chance to mention, but I will, is that he actually translated the Bible into German. And I would say that because of that influence, it could be argued, don't you think, he actually did pull the Catholic Church back from the brink of some terrible heresies.
I think there have been many reforms over the last 500 years within the Catholic Church, especially in the last 50 or so years, that Luther was calling for. I mean, the Mass in the language that the people could understand, and a lot of stuff that was commonsensical. And now when I go to a Catholic church, visiting with friends or something, I see things and I go, this is amazing. I mean, imagine in Luther's time if they'd been doing this or this or this. They're singing Protestant hymns. One thing that's crazy, congregational singing. If you go to a church, Catholic, Protestant, whatever, and you sing hymns, that was not happening until Luther. People never participated in worship. The choir would sing or the monks would sing, but the congregation, I mean, imagine, you want to talk influence? How many hymns have been sung? How many people sing church every week over the centuries? That is all because Martin Luther said, we need to worship God, we need to sing, and he wrote songs, and he wrote hymns, and he really was obsessed with bringing God to everybody, not just to the priests and the bishops. It's so amazing that at least knowing the story, I think, for us is important, and the 500th anniversary is a good time to focus on it.
Absolutely, and I can't wait to read it, honestly. I mean that, Eric, because I remember, I just know how Bonhoeffer affected my life. This is very different. You mentioned that already. When you think of, we only have a couple of minutes left here, Martin Luther, we know a lot about him. We know a lot about him. So how in the world did you narrow your focus for writing this book?
Well, actually, it wasn't so hard. I have to say two things. First of all, there's a ton that we know about Luther that's absolutely not true. So part of my book ends up debunking six or seven things that it was kind of shocking when you're talking about somebody over 500 years, these legends build up and people keep saying it over and over and over. For example, the idea that his wife, escapes this nunnery inside a beer barrel, or usually people say a herring barrel that had been used, to smelly fish were in this barrel. That is in every single book on Luther. It's not true. I guarantee you it didn't happen. I can tell you how the rumor started, but it's not true. And there's a lot of things about Luther that we think we know. And so without really intending to, just when you try to tell the story, you realize, wow, that's not true. I mean, there's something that happened at the beginning of his life. I won't tell it now because it is a whopper of a miracle. I will talk about this in Richmond and in most of my speeches on Luther around the country in the next few weeks. It's huge. No one else has written about it. When I discovered it, I was stunned, because you feel, who am I to discover this when this has been 500 years and people are writing books? But so the day after he was born, something happened. I won't go into it now, but I mean, there's a number of nuggets that I found. Even the idea of nailing the 95 theses, it's turned into this kind of legend.
Eric,
that we don't know what happened.
I have to say,
I just wanted to tell the story,
Eric,
for a new audience
you.
In an entertaining way.
And you will. All right, it's going to be... Eric, you have to come back, and we have to spend more time. But if you want to hear more of this, Family Foundation this Saturday night, familyfoundation.org. The book is called Martin Luther, The Man Who Rediscovered God and Changed the World, coming out. It's already out. Just came out this week. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.